Well, good morning, everyone. As John mentioned, today is Peace Sunday, the Sunday right before Remembrance Day ceremonies. And Amos is the minor prophet that's being emphasized this week in the cycle that John has been bringing. So I invite you to read the book of Amos on your own. I'm not going to be reading large sections of the book of Amos this morning. I do want to mention to you that the message that Amos brings in his book is one of social justice and calling out the disparities between God's desires and what he saw as the self-centered practices of the northern kingdom. So some of you would know that back then, Israel was broken into two kingdoms. There was Judea at the south, and there was Israel to the north, and Israel was that section where Samaria was. And there was conflict between the two ends of the nation because all the pure Hebrew people were mostly located in the south, and the people in the north had intermarried with the nations around them, so they had picked up some of the practices of the north. And that caused conflict that you can see still being reflected down to this very day. Like, this region of the world has always had its conflicts. And so that aspect of it, the social justice piece, is an important part of peace, and that's what I'd like to spend some time on this morning. And so to do so, I'd like to highlight the one verse from Amos chapter 3, verse 3 that suggests this when he asks, "Do two walk together unless they have agreed to do so?" Or as the King James puts it, "Is it, except they be agreed." Or the idea being, can two people walk together if they cannot agree with one another? Apparently, it's not that easy, and I'm sure you've experienced that in your own life. It's pretty difficult when you aren't agreeing with the person that you're trying to engage. And we know that as we meet together today, there are conflicts brewing everywhere. There are political conflicts involving different ideologies, and there are wars involving that. And, you know, you look at what's happening in Sudan, as well as what's happening in Israel and Hamas in Gaza, and, of course, the Ukraine conflict. But beyond that, we still haven't been able to get past the racial conflicts, and we're seeing those raise their ugly head again. I lived through the 60s down in the U.S. when, you know, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and they were trying to raise social justice issues involving race, and they went away for a while, kind of, and now they're back, like they never left. We have conflicts over the subject of a woman's right to control her own health care and body. People take different points of view on that, that raise the possibility of even abortion clinics being blown up and stuff like that. We thought that went away. Apparently, that's a problem again. Now we're having discussions around what gender means, and there's conflict around that. In fact, some would say the whole U.S. election turned on the subject of how you viewed transgender issues and the subject of using they, them as personal pronouns. So there's all of that. There's conflicts about justice, injustice, family dynamics, the social stratification, just about anything that a person can disagree about with another person seems to be happening, but it's nothing new. You know, it always has been that way. Even if you think the political conflicts of today are something novel, just watch old movies. And you see that, you know, they had the same problems, you know, back 50, 75 years ago with self-interested people trying to elevate their own interests over that of the nation. It's always been a problem. It's nothing new. And then there's conflicts about theology and religion, which are forever ongoing as well. And, you know, I'm not going to be really critical of the idea of people disagreeing about things because, you know, my wife and I have been married 52 years now, and we still can't agree on which way the toilet paper hangs. You know, and we play those games where I'll turn it one way and she'll turn it the other way, and, you know. After all these years, we can't even settle that difference. And, you know, pretty much from the start, and I think many of you who are married can identify with this, we've not seen everything in this world similarly. We've seen our own aspects of how things are, you know, theologically, politically, and whatnot, although we mostly agree politically. I guess all couples can say that. And if peace requires agreement, then peace is not likely to happen because no two people agree about everything, and at no time in the future is that going to change. So the only friend that I still have from high school when I lived in the States, I had many friends when I left, it boils down to one. And that one fellow that I've maintained a relationship with is an avid supporter of Donald Trump. And the only reason I mention that is because it could have been a destroyer of our relationship. And it almost was, because I'll confess quite openly that I am not. So several years back, we agreed that discussing that topic was off the table. We care about our friendship enough to keep the Donald out of it. And so, you know, this discussion started back in 2015 when he hadn't even been elected president the first time yet. And that's how long we discussed, and we've been able to maintain a 10-year relationship now without having to talk about him at all. Thank God. We cannot walk together if we cannot agree to at least that much. And I can think I support something better than him without naming his allegiances as evil or stupid. And that's what often happens when people disagree with somebody else in their position. We have to label them as evil or dumb. I can't preach the importance of empathy and compassion without attempting to understand what concerns him. I know our values and ideals don't simply fall from the sky. They come from somewhere. What we think, what we believe, what we support is the fruit growing on the branches of the biases that have been imparted to me. I don't have a cold. I have allergies, and perfume is one of them, so I pick up scents, and so I make sure I have Kleenex with me when I'm preaching. Now, I know as soon as I say that I'm potentially making some of you uncomfortable as soon as you raise the idea of bias. Because to some people, bias is a negative word that we use to dismiss the perspectives of someone else. You're biased. You know, the reason you're saying that is you're biased. We hear that all the time as a way of expressing disagreements. Like, we can pull that out to be an easy way of discounting what you're telling me. And bias can be an ugly thing when it is conscious and judgmental. Prejudice, discrimination, and hatred are nurtured. They're not innate. Prejudice, discrimination, and hate aren't something we're born with. Those are things that are nurtured. And I want you to remember this point because I'm going to come back to it in a few minutes. But unconscious bias is different because its weakness is lack of information, lack of experience, and a small pond. So the fact that we don't see everything altogether clearly makes us vulnerable to seeing the world through the lens of the very small pond that we are able to float on. I like the Sufi story of the blind man. I think I've raised this here before in a sermon some time back. Some of you may know the Sufi story of the blind man attempting to describe an elephant. And, you know, the one is grabbing the leg and he's saying that an elephant is like a tree stump, and then another one is grabbing the end of the tail, and he's saying that an elephant is like a furry little mouse. And another one is grabbing the ear, and he's saying it's like a sheath of leather. And another grabs the trunk and says it's like a great big snake. So all of them are grasping the elephant, but they're grasping aspects of it that limit their ability to see the whole picture. So people are limited in judgment to what they experience and see. And often, that's not enough to draw broad conclusions about anything. And, you know, that's what we have to keep in mind. Just because we can see certain things doesn't mean we're seeing enough to be able to judge the whole picture. I have another friend whose thinking about God was radically different than mine. In fact, he had a hate on for religion and the very idea of God. And the only reason I have a relationship with him is because being that guy at Waypoint, being director of ethics and spiritual care there, he sought me out at lunch and in a very public setting tried to corner me with some of his arguments. And he's very well versed in the perspectives of what are called the new atheists. I don't know if any of you have read these guys, like Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, and Daniel Dennett. I've read them all. And he would approach me in the lunchroom locked and loaded, ready to rumble. And he was one who just loved talking about God from that negative perspective. And he was always looking for a worthy opponent. In fact, I once told him that he thought more about God than most believers do. For a guy that didn't believe in God, he sure occupied a lot of his mind and his time. But what he got from me, instead of me being defensive and arguing back, and this is what I tend to do with a lot of my work, even when I'm working with someone as a mental health professional, what he got from me was a lot of drilling down. Now, drilling down is a therapeutic technique where you try to get underneath the surface stuff that you're hearing to locate what's underneath and what's important. So rather than taking the bait when he asked me to defend my position of faith, I would ask why his question was important. And I'd do that over and over again. So when he would give me his answer as to why that question was important, I'd say, well, why is that important? And then why was that important? Until we got down to the brass tacks and the root of his perspective, because arguing the existence of God, which is something that he liked to do, is a distraction if the real point is he's feeling life is unjust. Like, why does a person take the perspective that God does not exist? What is the driving force behind that belief? So that's where I wanted to get with him, defending the idea that God is loving. And that's another thing that we like to do sometimes as Christians, is really unkind when you think about it, if what the person is dealing with is the pain of loss and they're trying to reconcile a loving God with the terrible things that happen in this world. You know, going right to the fact you're out to lunch, God is love. When they're not feeling that in their life, doesn't make a lot of sense. We need to appreciate the question before a response can ever make sense. And so maybe not trying to win an argument is more Christian and kind than defending God who needs no defending. So over time, this guy and I became pretty good friends. He allowed me to make him a character in my book, Bending Light, where I provide a window into our relationship. So if anyone's ever interested in reading more about this guy, there's a couple chapters that he features in. And I really do consider him one of my favorite friends, even though we don't agree on everything. And oddly enough, that doesn't mean we don't agree on some things, because we do. And I can actually say that he's made a lot of movement. In fact, I wasn't going to put this in here, but today he sings in the Welsh Men's Choir. And he's traveling all across Canada and the United States singing the great hymns of the faith. You know, he spends time in church every week, you know. And he told me at some point that while he's not religious, he doesn't believe in God, he can actually say that he's spiritual now. He's got a spiritual dynamic. So good for him. So people can walk together while agreeing to disagree. In fact, to my way of thinking, it's impossible to walk together unless we do. And I want to say that peace is not dependent on finding middle ground. And that's where everybody seems to want to go when they're trying to find a place where they can get things to settle down. It does not require middle ground, because there are some perspectives that are binary and resistant to compromise. You just can't find middle ground on them. For instance, abortion. There's no middle ground on that. These days, there's a lot of discussion of medical assistance in dying. There's no middle ground on that. Capital punishment, perspectives around gender, and an array of other moral questions that really have no middle ground. And, you know, because I do a lot of work in ethics, I've had to have discussions from a moral perspective, a moral ethical perspective on all of these things, and probably more than I am able to remember over the years. And where we often make our mistake is when we focus on our own biases as the one and only standard. You cannot have a conversation about a binary issue without having some openness to appreciating what's coming from the other side. Made, as an example, is morally wrong because only God can decide when someone dies. That's a common position you hear. God's the only one who can decide when someone dies. You can't make that decision on your own. Or made is morally right because no one should tell anyone else what to do with their own life. You don't know what the other person is suffering, so that's another argument. So instead of focusing on the act of made in such discussions, I think it's better to focus on what the person values the most, that drilling down thing. Because often, the person who opposes made values the idea of the sanctity of human life. So, you know, the Roman Catholic Church is one of the largest proponents of this idea of the sanctity of life, and they use that as the reason for not supporting MAID and abortion and a whole host of things. So to those who take that perspective, life is what is important and its dependence on the will of God. In healthcare, it's interesting that the opposers of MAID don't often use that argument, even in our hospital. They would say that to participate in taking a life is a violation of the Hippocratic Oath, because the Hippocratic Oath begins with the principle of prima non nocera, or means first do no harm. And so many of our docs would say, we can't participate in this, not because we have a religious perspective or a belief in God, but because when we take the oath as a physician, we're saying we're not going to do that. We're going to protect life. And you cannot harm another without doing harm to yourself is another point of view that often gets raised. And that a society cannot allow that harm without undermining the morality of society. So some of you may have heard of that as the slippery slope argument. If you allow something that is immoral, it can drag down not only the individuals who are doing it, but all those that are affected by it. So those who oppose MAID may value life, the will of God, or doing no harm as several possibilities. And they're all pretty strong arguments when you think about it. The supporter of MAID often values compassion and limiting suffering. So to deny the option of MAID to those individuals is to condemn someone to live in pain. Forcing someone to suffer, in their perspective, is cruel and inhumane. I've had these discussions with those of our physicians who agree we should be probably allowing MAID. I hear things like, we have more compassion for dogs and horses than we do for human beings. You know, that's one of the arguments that are used on that side. So in healthcare, the supporter of MAID often also cites the principle of autonomy. So in ethics, like, there are four major principles that are used in medical ethics. And the first one is personal autonomy, which says, if I'm capable of making a decision for myself, then I have the right to choose for myself. Nobody can tell me what to do because I have personal autonomy. And I'm sure that in every other case, when you think about it in terms of healthcare, when it comes down to your own healthcare, everybody's a fan of personal autonomy because they don't want anybody telling us what to do with our own health. You know, it's just that for some people, when it gets to the subject of deciding you're going to die early, you know, then it becomes a problem. So supporters value compassion over the notion of life at all costs. And that's really the binary argument. Can you value something over life? And they may value personal choice over the forced perspectives of others. So how do we walk together if we see this question differently? Because a life hangs in the balance, along with its dignity and its quality. So I wonder, when it comes to those binary issues, if we can start by admitting that neither side is out to lunch. That's why I tried to work really hard to show you the perspectives on both sides. You can take a perspective without having to think the other person's out to lunch or is evil. Because valuing life is important and making sure our approaches protect the vulnerable from making knee-jerk decisions. And this has been one of the reasons why the Canadian government parked the whole thing for like 5 years so they could keep looking at it, is they don't want people making quick decisions that, you know, they would later, if they could, regret because advances were made in healthcare, whatever the case may be. But having compassion for irremediable suffering is important as well, and not judging and abandoning people who decided they've had enough. We can have an opinion on which of those values best expresses what we see as right without naming the other as evil because they personally see it differently. Because how can we walk together unless we can agree to disagree and give one another permission to work through our own moral questions? You know, nobody should be standing on your neck forcing you to make your own moral decisions. We all have to make the one that respects our conscience, because Romans 14 says it doesn't matter whether it's right or wrong. If it's wrong for you, it's wrong. So You know, the black and white of right and wrong includes your conscience, which must be respected, so we have to include that for those who may even disagree with us. So in my way of discussing these debatable issues, drilling down, I think, is the important first step, because the person's opinion on what's going on is only the flower, you know, the visible representation of whatever idea they happen to hold. We need to get somewhere below the surface to the root that's feeding that flower and is bringing it into a full bloom. You know, that's what matters more. Why a person takes the perspective they do. And if we value the person more than their perspective, we will respect them enough to know what informs their opinions. Otherwise, we're only bullying them into conforming to our expectations. I have made this point in my discussions with Catholic Healthcare when representing Waypoint in discussions about MAID. I was allowed with our CEO to go to Toronto and not only meet with Catholic Healthcare, but people in the government. We were still forming our perspectives on medical assistance in dying. It was back when we were calling it physician-assisted death, or PAD. We called it physician-assisted death before we called it medical assistance in dying, and it was that long ago. And one of the things they kept bringing up in Catholic healthcare was the idea of scandal as being a value in the discussion. It's kind of a view of the slippery slope. They kept bringing up, yeah, what do we do as Catholic theologians, as a Catholic group, if we allow MAID? We have to protect the image of Catholic healthcare, was the message. We can't cooperate with MAID because doing so would not be legitimate cooperation, which is another word they like to use. You can cooperate with something you don't agree with as long as as long as your central values are maintained. So that's what they're talking about, using this concept of scandal. And the danger in using concepts like scandal and legitimate cooperation is that it's really not about the individuals involved at all. It's all about us. It's not about the actual person in question or the conflict itself. You know, it's all about how are we going to look if we support this? You know, how am I going to come out in people's eyes if I support this? And it's an easy position to take, self-centered as it may be. And you would think, well, you know, something like MAID, I could see that happening. Well, I don't want to embarrass Joel, but when he was 13, he was invited to play second base for our regional hardball team in the All-Star game. And those invitations don't come very often. Didn't ever come for me. So it was definitely an honor for him to be asked to play in that All-Star game. Problem was that it was happening on a Sunday near Owen Sound. And to make a long story short, I neither went nor allowed him to go because I thought, you know, if I did agree to this, and this is back when they were still doing the battle about trying to keep Sunday somewhat a respected day in the week. So I thought I needed to make my stand on this and not give in, because I thought it would make me look derelict in my pastoral responsibilities. You know, I was pastoring here at the time. So whatever you want to call it, it was scandal by any other name. And so as a result, he didn't get to play in that game, because I expected him to conform to my view. And so putting my personal reputation example ahead of celebrating a tremendous accomplishment is something that I regret to this very day. Wish I had that day back. So the heart of peace of any kind is a willingness to understand what's important to the other and the willingness to agree to disagree. And walking together in humility and love is more important than imposing our will. And if the peace is worth compromising, it requires more than a difference of opinion to disturb it. And too often that's what we let disturb the peace, just a simple disagreement in ideas. I happen to think times do exist when the weak and vulnerable have to be protected or to stem the tide of oppression. I personally cannot agree to disagree in the face of prejudice, discrimination, and hate, or see it as right to do so. So if I encounter that, I'm going to say something. The couple times in my life when I have not done so and have kicked myself afterwards taught me that no, if If I'm seeing something that qualifies as bullying happening and I remain silent, I'm a part of the problem. So I can't agree to be peaceful when the other person's values abuse and destroy another. Because sometimes peace requires us to stand up and say, your bullying will not be tolerated. I will embrace a difference of opinion, but I will not let a victim stand alone. Or let me say, it's my goal, it's my desire to not let a victim stand alone. And I can be as forceful as needed as long as my response is measured and proportional. You know, that's another thing you think about when you're wondering about ethical actions. You know, you don't have to kill a fly with a sledgehammer. You know, it's a proportional kind of response. And you don't need to resort to violence when a simple rebuke will do. It's not all or nothing. Edmund Burke said, many of you will know his quote, that the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good people to do nothing. Disagreeing or valuing different kinds of good are not evil. I hope that message comes across, gives you something to think about. Just disagreeing and having difference of opinion, even on binary issues, does not make the other person evil or stupid. Evil is abusing others for the purpose of supporting our own selfish needs or biases. When other people are hurt because we need to protect our own interests, asking the right questions when faced with a difference of opinion is better than digging in. So drilling down, taking the time to really try to understand and appreciate what drives the other person's perspective. And what most often serves me well, maybe you also, as trite and as well-traveled as it is the idea, what would Jesus do? Now, I may not always know what Jesus would do, because I'm bringing my personal opinions into that evaluation, but I'm going to get closer to doing the right thing if I'm considering, if Jesus was facing this situation, how would Jesus handle it? You know, when you look at how Jesus handled things in the New Testament, you don't see him dismissing, demeaning, devaluing individuals very often. Usually that helps me identify what would be the most reasonable form of good. So, how you apply this discussion of peace in your own life is going to require you to bring something of your own ideas and values alongside the decisions you need to make. And so, peace be with you as you embrace that calling in your personal lives. Please join me in a word of prayer. Lord, as we think upon the many difficult things we have to decide in our lives, the questions that do ask people to consider more broadly the whole picture rather than just their own, give us the ability to try to understand those around us, beginning with those in our own families and ending with those with whom we have profound disagreement. In Jesus' name, amen.